I have. Since the earliest days of the ADS-CFT correspondence, I was very excited about the possibility. Well, what ADS-CFT showed was that string theory could say something interesting about a particular quantum field theory, N equals 4 super Yang-Mills. And I was immediately excited about the possibility, well, why can't string theory tell us something just as interesting or maybe even more interesting about QCD? So I guess I didn't appreciate the full, I thought at that time that maybe we were a lot closer than we are, but it's not so easy, it seems, to learn something about QCD from string theory along the same lines as the ADS-CFT correspondence. So I don't have results to talk about, but I do have some ideas and some thoughts about how one might go about doing this. I'm going to organize my talk in sort of three stages. The first stage is to take one step back from the ADS-CFT correspondence, by which I mean go back to the string theory from which it came, alpha prime greater than zero, and remind each of us why ADS-CFT is possible, and what is it about string theory that leads to ADS-CFT. Then the next step will be sort of a review of light cone string, light cone world sheets. And after reviewing that, I want to close that section with a description of how one might actually sum planar diagrams using the light cone world sheet as a template. And then the last part, a few remarks about ideas for fitting QCD into this scheme. Okay. Of these things, one and two are mostly, I assume, pretty well known to this audience, maybe not to everyone in the audience, but to most people. A few new little ideas maybe you'll see in the last part. Okay, so why is ADS-CFT, why is it possible? What is it about string theory that leads to ADS-CFT? From the very earliest days of string theory, we realized, we meaning the big we, everyone that was working on it, that if you started with an open string theory, a string with ends, and considered the interacting version of it, closed strings were inevitable. And the reason is that the interactions take place in string theory by an open string breaking or rejoining at a point, breaking in at a point in the interior or ends rejoining. And if it rejoins once, then if two ends can rejoin, then the two ends of an open string can also rejoin. So if you're going to allow that interaction, you also have to allow two ends that find themselves near each other to join. So open strings and closed strings are inevitably there together. Of course, you can, and it was also realized later on, that you could do away with the open strings if you started with a closed string theory, but you couldn't do the other way around. If you start with an open string theory, you inevitably have closed strings along with it. Also, very early on in the game, people like Sherk, and later together Neveu and Sherk, realized that open string theory has gauge theory as a low energy limit. So if we sort of think of the low energy limit as alpha prime going to zero, open string theory with Chan-Peyton factors has a low energy limit, which is non-abelian gauge theory. So this was already a well-known part of string theory before the ADS-CFT correspondence was was envisioned. Similarly, later on, when people started thinking a little more seriously about closed strings, they realized that the closed string theory in the same limit is the gravity. The low energy limit of closed string theory is the gravity theory. So what I would like to pinpoint as the sort of the parent of ADS-CFT is, and this, saying it this way doesn't require supersymmetry or conformal or the CFT or the supersymmetry. The parent of it is what I call open string, closed string duality. And this is something that is true about string theory. And so any theory that can be that is a descendant of string theory should reflect this fact in some way or other. Okay, but all I've said so far is that open strings and closed strings go together, inevitably together. But duality is not and, duality is or. The duality says that you can look at something at a physical phenomenon one way or another way. So if I'm going to talk about open-closed duality, I have to explain why I have to isolate a situation in which an open string description is one alternative and a closed string description is another alternative of the same thing. And for that, we need an innovation of a Tuft. His large n limit, which I'm not going to go through the details of why this is true, but the large n limit set basically says that you restrict yourself to planar diagrams. Now he was thinking of this tool in the context of gauge theory, but we can also think of it in the context of open string theory, because open strings are sort of an extension of gauge theory, and when we attach Chan-Peyton factors to the ends of the open string to put internal symmetry in, then the large n limit of that gauge group will give us again planar open string diagrams. Now, something that is completely true in string theory is that the sum over all planar, I have to add a couple of adjectives here, planar open string diagrams. Let me emphasize all numbers of loops. On the one hand, can be thought of completely in terms of open strings, or it can be thought of as a sum over closed string trees. And the reason is something that Joe referred to in his overview talk. If I think of a world sheet with lots of holes in it, all of the quantum numbers are on the edge of this world sheet. All of the quantum numbers on the holes have been summed over. So each hole can be thought of as a closed string that is being absorbed or emitted, absorbed into the vacuum or absorbed from the vacuum. So instead of thinking of this as open string loops, which I'm sort of thinking of unitarity cuts like so, where every intermediate state is an open string, I can think of this as a single world sheet which is emitting lots of closed strings, and the closed strings are being absorbed into the vacuum. And it's not, I don't think of that and the open string, it's or. This is the duality. This is open string, closed string duality, and it's referred to the planar limit or the large n limit.
Are you thinking of conformal invariance?
I'm not thinking of anything other than string theory. Well, some, yes, whatever's necessary. I'm just insisting that the string theory be consistent.
Is the size of the hole in the loop relevant or not?
Well, the size is something that is referred to the metric of the world sheet, which is integrated over. So it's not like a fixed size.
I suppose right. Fixed
I'm going to do LightCon, which is sort of an example.
Okay, I'm just waiting to
yeah, I'll do further. Yeah, I mean, so in that, when you attach the world sheet coordinates to something physical, then the size of the hole is actually something that's integrated over or summed over. But now we can think about ADS-CFT in this context. If we take, so in ADS-CFT, the open string theory that we're using is just the NSR superstring, open superstring. And if we take the alpha prime goes to zero limit of the left-hand side, we just get large n, n equals 4.
The number of moduli for open string is like three times the number of holes. For each hole, you get three moduli. Whereas for each closed string vertex operator, you only get two moduli, the position of the vertex operator.
Mm-hmm.
If I do a closed string, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not doing a closed string. I mean, maybe I should make this a little more precise. I mean the world sheet that I am discussing, that has lots of holes in it, can be thought of as the same world sheet in a closed string background.
I'm just saying that there's more moduli on one side than on the other.
Well, I don't see it.
I mean, for a loop, you have the size of the loop. You have three moduli for each loop. It's like 3H.
Mm-hmm.
Or is the number of H right over? Yeah. Are you saying only after integrating over all the moduli, it's very
different? Yeah, we're integrating over all the moduli.
Okay.
I mean, there's nothing. We don't have fixed moduli on this. This is the whole answer. This is the whole shebang, and this is the whole shebang. And they're just two different ways of viewing the same thing. But the fact that you have these two different ways of viewing it is what leads to field string duality, because on the open string side, the low energy limit is just the appropriate gauge theory, the planar limit of the appropriate gauge theory. And on the closed string side, the limit is supergravity. Now, a subtlety is that alpha prime going to zero is not enough to get a supergravity description on this side, but you also need a Tuft coupling. In order to have a classical description, since this is closed string trees, it's classical. All of the closed string diagrams that come into these vacuum emissions and absorptions are tree diagrams. There's no loops. And that's because it's planar. The open string diagrams are planar. So, you know, it's like deforming this guy into a world sheet. Well, here's one emission. And the open string, there's no momentum flowing into that boundary, so it's just disappearing into the vacuum. So the low energy limit of this theory is n equals 4, and this is gravity. And as I understand it, I mean, maybe I don't understand completely why this is so important, but as I understand it, it's because the solution of this is singular near the... So we're doing basically... We're going to a four-dimensional theory by Joe's idea of D3 brains, and we are... the metric near the brain is singular. And in order for n g squared alpha prime squared over r to the fourth to be large, where r is not of order the string scale, where r stays small compared to the string scale, you have to have n g squared large. If you don't have n g squared large, then apparently you can't just replace the closed string theory with the supergravity theory. You have to replace it. I mean, you have to actually deal with closed string field theory rather than a supergravity approximation. Okay. Any questions so far?
So the first thing is we need some closing preamble. Am I supposed to sum over all kinds of external states also, or is it...
No, fixed? Just fix some fixed sort of states. I mean, say, for example, do an open string propagator, and then all possible closed string emissions into the vacuum.
Okay, all possible closed string. Okay.
So. Tree level, with no closed string loops.
So, I mean, the argument you gave is so general that you might be tempted to say if you just stay in 10 dimensions and don't worry about, you know, free brains, then would you claim that there's some duality between Yang-Mills theory in 10 dimensions and gravity?
Large N, Yang-Mills, and gravity.
In what background? 10 dimensions? Is it just flat space?
Well, I guess in 10 dimensions, maybe you need something transverse to the brains to have a, because the gravity is coupling to the D3 brains in this realization. In 10 dimensions, there are no brain. Well, it's a space-filling brain. I wanted to think about it. So I'm not sure what the description says then. Okay, so anyway, this is the reason I wanted to put this in a general context is, first of all, to say that you can have a different attitude toward this whole thing. You could think of the open string theory as a regularization of the gauge theory, and it's a regularization in which the parent of string field duality is manifest because of this property of string theory. If it's really true that, and this I think I do understand fairly clearly, if it's true that this arrow can only be drawn at strong a Tuft coupling, then for QCD it's very disappointing if you're going to use this type of a picture, because you would have to do it at strong coupling, the strong gauge coupling, strong a Tuft gauge coupling. And QCD is asymptotically free, and more than that, a good deal of the most important physics that's been measured about QCD is at weak coupling. So it would be very disappointing if you depended upon strong coupling to analyze QCD this way. So my attitude about this is, let's not be so hasty in taking alpha prime to zero. Let's see what we can do or what we can think about doing in the original string theory before taking alpha prime to zero. And specifically, I want to think about doing QCD that way. Because of all the symmetries of n equals 4, you can actually take alpha prime out of the considerations explicitly. This was Juan's original argument. But in QCD, it may be a little bit too early to do that, to try to take alpha prime to zero from the beginning. Okay, so that's my look back at the origins of ADS-CFT. So the idea is that we should be looking at ways to sum planar open string diagrams. And I'm going to be talking about the light cone as a technology to develop to do that. Okay, so first I have to review light cone. And then get to the point where you can actually start looking at the sum of planar diagrams and saying something about them. Okay. So I'm going to be just using the description for the bosonic string where there are no fermionic coordinates. Although the theory that I'm ultimately interested in is the one with is something like the Nevers-Schwartz model with fermionic coordinates. Nambu's action for the string is reparameterization invariant, and we have to either fix the we either have to integrate over x. All of the x's and include Fadeyev-Popov ghosts to respect reparameterization invariants, or we need to fix the parameterization completely. Light cone is a way to fix it completely, and the way you do it is as follows. You choose, well, first of all, let me define the plus and minus components of any vector. As v time plus or minus v3, where I've just picked some direction in space arbitrarily. And then the light cone parameterization is to choose x plus of sigma and tau equal to, well, I'm going to say tau for the moment, but it's actually going to be minus I tau because I'm going to be working in imaginary time. That fixes one of the parameterizations. And then the other parameterization is fixed by choosing the density of P plus on the string to be a constant. So those are the two conditions for light cone gauge. Once you fix those, there's no more reparameterization invariance. Okay, now, you can either quantize with operators or with path integrals. And I'm going to think about path integrals. So what's left? So these are fixed by the parameterization choice. And then the opposite ones, x minus and p minus, are eliminated by the constraints. And then when the dust settles, you end up with an action that looks like this. Tau is integrated over, say, between 0 and t. Sigma is integrated from 0 to the total p plus of the string. And all you have for an action is what anyone would recognize as the action for a non-relativistic string in the transverse coordinates. When I take I times the action and go to imaginary time, which I want to do from now on, this becomes minus, now tau is imaginary, that sign becomes plus, and we have x dot squared plus t0, x prime squared. So, to quantize with path integrals, you integrate over all configurations of e to the I action, which, since we've gone to imaginary time, so the domain on which these world sheet fields are defined has a shape that is fixed by the parameters of the evolution that you're looking at. T represents the total imaginary time of the evolution, and P plus represents the width of the strip. So I'm drawing it this way. That's P plus, and this is time. And if I do the path integral over that domain, I will get the propagation function for a string prepared in some configuration here to be seen in some configuration at some later time t. Okay, now let's take this to be our fixed observable, this open string propagator. Then what are the sum of planar loops? All I do is decorate this rectangle with lots of horizontal lines. At the beginning of a horizontal line, a string that was just an intact string splits into two strings, like so. Here it would split again. Here, two strings would join. So what I am drawing here is just a literal space-time diagram of a string that breaks and rejoins into arbitrary numbers of pieces as time evolves. if I want to sum over all planar diagrams, all of these diagrams are planar. If I want to sum over all of them, I have to sum over all numbers of these internal slits. Over all, these are the three, there are two times, these are the three moduli you spoke about, Nathan. There are two times and a height for each of these loops. So you're integrating over all the moduli. So all of the locations and sizes of the loops. So all numbers of loops, all locations of the loops in this worksheet diagram, and all sizes. Okay, so each of these holes in the worksheet that I drew before is represented by a slit. The worksheet X is discontinuous across the slit. Okay. Any questions? I want to make one important point about this basic interaction. You see, P plus conservation is incorporated in this sum geometrically because these slits have zero length. Sigma is a measure of P plus. The total width of a strip represents the P plus the string carries. And here a string with P plus 1 and P plus 2 combines to a string of total P plus 1 plus P plus 2. If the path integral, this is a quantum path integral which is properly normalized according to probabilities. This amplitude, because of relativity, ought to behave like 1 over the square root of the product of the three P pluses coming in. Then it can also depend on the ratios of the P pluses and on the ratios of the times to the P pluses. And so on. But the important thing is that the scaling with the size of the diagram, so P plus is directly related to the size of the diagram. If I scale the size of the diagram, it should behave, if I multiply all the P pluses and T's by a scale parameter lambda, this amplitude should behave like lambda to the minus 3/2. And that's a condition for relativity. However, when you do the calculation, do the explicit calculation, you get lambda to the minus, and this is for the bosonic string, minus d minus 2 over 16. From this, the comparing of these two scaling laws says it must behave by Lorentz covariance like lambda to the minus 3/2, and behaves like minus to the d minus 2 over 16. Basically, each d is the dimension of space-time, so each of these transverse axes has a dimensionality of d minus 2, and I'm saying that each coordinate contributes a lambda to the minus 1 over 16. In order to have Lorentz covariance, you see that you need to have d equals 26, which is probably one of the most elemental and simplest ways to see the role of the critical dimension in this formalism. It's also true, as we showed a long time ago, that the Lorentz algebra closes only in 26 dimensions. But this is a little bit more direct. So the light cone formalism is only going to work nicely in the critical dimension. And one of the things that I'm going to suggest for QCD is that we might use a subcritical string, and then this problem would have to be dealt with if we do so. Any questions? Because the next one I want to do is discuss how we can think about this sum. Okay, so in order to do the large end open string theory, we want to sum over all these planar diagrams. And I want to describe two ways to think about the sum. Both of them a little bit, I think, interesting. One way to think about the sum is to notice that what these decorations are doing is just coloring points on this rectangle. If I introduce a variable to represent the presence or absence of a boundary inside, it just has two values. Either there's a boundary through a point or there's not a boundary through a point. That variable, if I sum over all configurations of that spin variable, I am summing over all loops, all planar loops. Now, this is something that my collaborator Giles and I did back in 1977, mixing a discrete variable with a continuous variable with a continuous world sheet is a little bit mind-boggling. But in any case, if you're going to do a lattice, if you're going to do a sum over histories, you want to latticize. You want to put this on a grid. So instead of thinking of it as a continuous world sheet, think of it as a grid. A very small grid I've drawn here. And then the presence or absence of a boundary is just whether or not there is a link going across, which this is. So what you're doing, so if you're doing the path integral, you have an x at each side that you're integrating over. All of the horizontal lines are continuous and uninterrupted, but the vertical lines are either there or they're not. So if I wanted to have a long slit, let's say that long, I would just delete the terms in the action that correspond to the link between this site and that site. So the upshot is that what we have here is a two-dimensional system in which you've got, at each site, you have a continuous variable xij that goes from minus infinity to infinity. And on each vertical link, you have a spin variable, Sij, which is either 1 or 0. Then you can replace the action by its discretized version . Let's say the upper index is time, so we have all of those links present. But the x prime squared term is multiplied by the spin variable Sij. Xi plus 1j minus xij squared. And then for the coupling constant, I have a coupling constant every time there is a spin flip. So if it goes from 1 to 0, or from 0 to 1, I have a factor of the coupling constant. So I write a combination of these Ising spins that has that property. And this is all multiplied by log g, because this is going into the exponent of the exponent of the factor in the path integral. That's the system. This system, for example, should be eminently analyzable by Monte Carlo integration. There are no negative signs. The weights, this is the, remember the action, it's e to the minus this that gives you the system. So this is a way to think about the sum over all planar loops on the light cone. You think of it as bosonic fields on each site, a spin, an Isaac spin variable on each link, on each vertical link. You sum over all spin variables, and you sum over all, and you integrate over all x's. Okay, so that's the first way to think about the sum over all planar light cone diagrams.
S's are all either 0 or 1.
Right. So the link is either on or off. So it's an Isaac system coupled to us to a field, a scalar, a bosonic, what do you call it, a Gaussian variable. Or I don't know, just a scalar field. Now, when we come to the superstring or the Navier-Schwarz string, it's a bit more complicated for two reasons. One is that you not only have bosonic variables, but you also have fermionic variables. And the other is that you, in addition, it's not just an overlap. The interaction in the superstring involves an insertion of the supercurrent, superconformal current at the beginning and end. So we've got lots of minus signs in the fermionic sum over histories. So Monte Carlo wouldn't be so good for that. So, and this, of course, is something that plagues lattice gauge theory people too. And various devices have to be invented to try to deal with that if one's going to try to simulate this. I suspect that the bosonic simulation with no minus signs is simply going to give nothing because it's likely to be there. Since there are no minus signs, there's no stabilization, and there probably won't be much of a system at all left. Yeah.
If I wanted to do that, first look at this picture and then fix the gauge. Imagining this before fixing a gauge, then.
You mean when it's still covariant?
Yeah, and then you will lose the Rothschild diffeomorphism because, for example, you lose rotations by introducing a lattice.
Oh, sure, that's certainly true, but you would have to take some kind of gauge fixing into account to define the path integral.
It could be a
conformal gauge, but then you would have ghosts. If you put ghosts in, you have this. You put minus signs into the integrand of even the bosonic string. And it becomes less analyzable, at least for Monte Carlo simulations. See, one of my ideas is that I want to think about this problem so that if analytic solution fails, at least you have a system to put on a computer. And, well, as I say, for the superstring, that's going to involve conceptual problems to deal with the sum over histories with a Monte Carlo approach. Yeah.
Superstring, you will also have probably problems like doubling of the fermions and things like that. If you consider Raymond Navier-Schwarz, right, for example.
Right. And so, since it's a two-dimensional system, one can actually do a trick. I don't know how effective this would be, but a Majorana-Fermi field in two dimensions could be represented by the Ising model, the critical Ising model. So you could replace the Navier-Schwarz field by an Ising system. It has to be critical in order to reproduce the fermionic field, but that would not involve any minus signs. So there are possibilities in two dimensions that wouldn't really be there for four-dimensional lattice gauge theory.
Correspond to going from Navier-Schwarz NSR to Green-Schwarz?
I'm sorry?
Would this actually correspond to going from NSR to Green-Schwarz?
I didn't catch the second part of your statement. I'm sorry, I didn't get the words.
So there are two formulations, Green-Schwarz superstring and NSR.
Uh-huh. On the light cone, they're basically equivalent.
I thought going from one to another would be like using Ising representation of fermions.
That's not my understanding. It's basically the triality of SO8. You know, the SO8 has a Dinkin diagram which has got three, and there's two spinner representations and a vector representation. And on the light cone, I mean, this is not the Green-Schwarz formalism in the covariant formulation, but on the light cone, there's a very simple relationship between.
So how does this Ising work, this trick?
That's a separate talk. But, I mean, let me just leave it at, you know that the critical Ising model is a Majorana fermion.
Yeah.
a massless Majorana fermion, and that's what an inverse Schwarzschild is. The only question is the boundary conditions.
You would couple to the bosons differently. They would couple to the bosons. They would couple differently to the X.
Well, you'd have to devise how they couple exactly. I mean, the only coupling in the world, besides the absence and presence of links, the only coupling is through the insertion, right?
Yeah.
So you'd have to worry about whether you were properly representing faithfully enough the superconformal invariance. I mean, you're losing it on the lattice, but you want, if it's faithful enough, then you will regain it back in the continuum limit. Anyway, so this is a way of thinking about the sum of planar diagrams that Giles and I did back in 1977.
Can you compute and compare with, I don't know, some closed string amplitude? Is there something you could do with the bosonic string?
We could certainly do individual diagrams.
No, but somehow try to compute this.
You mean sum over the spins?
Well, put it on computer.
Peter Orland has done some studies like this. And he's told me his basic result, which is basically that all that happens is you get an effective tension. I mean, you change the tension, the size of the tension. I don't know how robust his studies are.
So what exactly are you trying to produce with this large N? What do you expect?
Well, no, in Yang-Mills? Blue ball spectrum. In Yang-Mills. Now, in the bosonic string, I'm not sure what would be reproduced because I don't believe it's really a stable theory.
How would you see that? Can you see that from this stable
theory? Well, I mean, you want to minimize the action, right? All the spins z equal to zero seem to minimize the action. That's basically saying that the system is just a bunch of free particles. The system has just fallen apart into a bunch of, someone said, lint. The fabric has fallen apart into. So it looks, I mean, so that's a very, very glib way of analyzing it, but it seems certainly true that if I just put all the S's, if I turn off all the links, I'll have a lower energy than if any of the links are present. So, I mean, that just means the tachyonic instability won't stabilize. I mean, that's what would happen if you have a tachyon. If you have a system that has that is a tachyon, it just breaks up indefinitely into more and more pieces.
You say that that's like taking the alpha prime going to infinity limit.
Or? Yeah, it's like turning off the tension. Okay, so I wanted to mention that way of thinking about the sum of planar diagrams. Then a clever fellow by the name of Martin Kruzhensky has proposed another way. He's Argentinian too. I'm going to draw the same picture. But now let me identify the initial state with the final state. So I'm saying, taking a trace like a thermal partition function with temperature being beta, 1 over T, 1 over the temperature. And now, so this is a generic system of loops, right? If I look at it from the closed string channel point of view, I can look at this thing either way. I can look at it that way where I'm seeing strings breaking and joining, breaking and joining, and breaking and joining. Or I can look at it this way, in which I see that there's at most, at least generically speaking, there's at most one hole per every interval of time evolution. Okay? So in other words, this is just like the sort of bubble sums that we're used to in perturbation theory. What happens is the bubble just goes into, well, if you're doing it in momentum space, the bubble goes into the denominator and shifts the mass squared. But if you do it in configuration space, the bubble exponentiates and just modifies the energy. So this way of thinking about the sum is to take the closed string Hamiltonian and literally adding a whole operator to it. A whole operator being the matrix element between two closed strings of a slit, of one slit. That's a very complicated problem too, because this is an infinite dimensional matrix. And you would have to diagonalize, but in a sense, this sums the whole diagonal. This is a realization of the old idea a long time ago, where an open string could always be deformed into a tadpole. And you could imagine summing all planar diagrams, or otherwise, just by doing a geometric sum of some kind. So, but this is true on the light cone. Notice, this gives you a picture of the interacting closed string, or the closed string interacting with open strings, in which the picture you would normally draw would have vertical slits everywhere. So this is the natural way of thinking about a closed string that breaks into an open string, maybe two open strings, rejoins and so on in all possible ways. But here, in this way of thinking about it, the closed string is viewed as, I'm not sure exactly what words to use, what happens at one of these slits, but there's a discontinuity in X across the slit. So there's this place where the closed string, the value of the closed string jumps in some way across the slit, and then you can just imagine doing the sum that way. It might be, actually, a good idea to do a T-dual transformation on the axis. Because when you do a T-dual transformation, so you have an original action that looks like this, x dot squared minus x prime squared times t0 squared. When you do a T-dual, where q is the other variable, this goes into q prime squared, let me go to imaginary time, plus 1 over t0 squared q dot squared. Yes?
Are you assuming the dimensions are compact? Because otherwise that should not be valid at higher genera, right?
Well, I mean, the Q value at each point has to be integrated over. I mean, all I'm doing is a transformation. Well, I mean, let's discuss that later. But all I'm doing is a transformation from something that obeys Neumann conditions to something that obeys Dirichlet conditions. And the Dirichlet conditions, however, are arbitrary and have to be integrated. The Dirichlet values have to be integrated over. In these variables, what's happening at this slit is that all of the Q variables are assuming the same value everywhere along this slit. And this is actually something that Michael Green was doing back in the 70s also. He was summing over all diagrams in which portions of the string shrank to a point instantaneously. He called them instantons. So, you know, if you go back far enough in string theory, you'll probably find a reflection of almost anything that's going on now. Okay, so this is another way. So there are these two different ways of thinking about it, and they don't look all that hopeless. So maybe it's okay and feasible and tractable to keep alpha prime not equal to zero. In some ways, it looks to me like the sum over planar diagrams for the open string theory is easier than it would be for the Yang-Mills theory. Okay, that's the end of my part two. It's probably the end of my, oh, it's not quite the end of my time. Okay. So are we ready to go on to some speculations and thoughts about QCD? So the attitude and the message I'm trying to draw here is it may not be so urgent to take the alpha prime goes to zero limit explicitly. There may be ways of, maybe on a computer, if not by hand, not analytically, there may be ways of dealing with the sum of open string planar diagrams with alpha prime not equal to zero. From that point of view, what do we need for QCD? We need an open string theory that reduces to QCD in the low energy limit. But how are we going to do that? Well, I'm sure there's lots of ways of doing this. Basically, since the low energy limit means basically alpha prime going to zero, any open string theory that has the low energy spectrum of QCD is going to have QCD as its low energy limit. What is the simplest known open string theory that has a low energy limit of QCD? That's a question. The simplest. We have, what have we got? We've got the bosonic string. We have the Nevers-Schwartz model. We have the Ramon model. And then the NSR model. The NSR model isn't going to, we don't want fermions. So we just want the NS model. But we don't want open string tachyons either. So we want, so I claim that the simplest model is what I call NS plus, the plus G parity, the even G parity sector of the Nevers-Schwartz model. How many dimensions? Four. Okay, the low energy limit of that theory is Yang-Mills, no extra massless particles. Compare that to the D3 brain interpretation. Same model, basically. So you take NS plus with D3 brains. So what is a D3 brain? The string is tied to the D3 brain, but its bulk can oscillate into the other. So let's make this critical. So D equals 10. This one doesn't give pure QCD in the low energy limit. It gives Yang-Mills coupled to 6 adjoint scalars. Massless adjoint scalars. So if you want to work in 10 dimensions, you've got to do something like an orbifold or some kind of projection that gets rid of these 6 adjoint scalars. Or you could, this is subcritical, so it has all the headache associated with subcritical dimensions, including a problem with fixing the, working in the light cone, as I mentioned before. But in some ways, this is the simplest because it doesn't involve any extra dimensions. But let me say it doesn't involve any extra dimensions explicitly, but as Joe pointed out in his overall talk, when you unitarize an open string model, you get a closed string sector. If you unitarize the subcritical D equals 4 NS plus model, you also get a closed string sector. You know, by deforming a non-planar loop. And, however, Lovelace says you violate unitarity. You get this nasty cut that has no interpretation in terms of unitarity. But I say, not so fast. Because what you discover is a cut in the closed string channel, but a cut is just a continuous mass spectrum. What happens when you have a D-brain and say one extra dimension, one extra non-compact dimension? Since you're not diagonalizing the momentum, the D-brain breaks the translational invariance, you couple to all of the continuous available values of the momenta. So the proper interpretation of this isn't a violation of unitarity. It's the holographic appearance of a fifth dimension. So I said it involves only 4 dimensions, but the closed strings that you get in here move in 5. And furthermore, you can actually do the calculation, and I hope I wrote it down somewhere here because I don't remember the, oh, here's the formula. You can do the calculation and show that when you transform to the closed string channel, log w goes to 1 over log q, you can interpret the cut. You just take that cut that you have there and interpret it as an integral over p5, over the, you know, you've broken translational invariance in the fifth dimension, so therefore you are coupled to all of the different continuous values of p5. So you interpret the cut in terms of p5. Okay, I'm basically copying down what the part that is added to the usual critical, the usual expression for the integrand. You get the following interesting formula. This is, so to speak, in the NSNS sector. And this is in the RR sector. Where beta plus or minus is the following thing, which people lovers of the Katz determinant will recognize immediately. If the dimension is 4, then of course you get, so the way you can think about this, if you introduce a scalar field, a wave function like e to the mu, e to the p5 times a number is basically a statement that the field has a Dirichlet value equal to that number. But you have a linear combination, you have an odd parity combination of this extra field, let's call it a Liouville field if you like, being plus or minus beta plus on one end over here, say, and plus or minus beta minus on the other end. Now, if I had just done D-brains, I wouldn't have these sine and cosine factors. The sine and cosine factors come because when you solve the physical state conditions in subcritical dimensions, you don't make every oscillator transverse. You have an uncancelled, you have an unassimilated 1 minus w to the 1 half that is not assimilated into a partition function. And these sine and cosine factors are just a reflection of that after the Jacobi imaginary transformation. Okay, so in other words, what I'm doing is basically saying Lovelace got the Liouville field before Polyakov. He just didn't recognize it.
Polyakov, so with the open strings still, they say the open strings don't, the endpoints don't move in the Liouville direction.
Right.
So they're fixed, you say, in some sense, if the value is beta plus and beta minus, is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that the extra dimension that's holographically generated is fixed at those values.
The extra dimension is fixed at those values.
So this is an extra transverse dimension. Now, and so it's
that integral runs from 0 to infinity, minus infinity?
Minus infinity to infinity. It's just like an extra dimension. Now, you see something very nice happens in 9 dimensions. This fixing the field equal to a complex value disappears. And then all you're doing is fixing it equal to 2, so a parity eigenstate under p goes to minus p. Okay, now, what's wrong with doing this 6 times? I mean, what you get when you unitarize the nonplanar loop is just one of these extra dimensions. But why not have 6 extra dimensions, all treated the same way? Then this imaginary term will disappear. Because this relationship is determined by making the conformal, the C value equal to 10. If you have 6 of these, the C value will be 10 when D is equal to, I mean, basically this is replaced by 8 over 1 over the square root of 2, and this one's gone. So that would be a D3 brain, not quite a D3 brain, because a D3 brain would not have these extra wave function factors at the endpoint. I'm out of time, but what I call that kind of D-brain is a non-abelian D-brain, maybe a bad choice of words, I don't know. But the reason is, well, let me just quickly say this, because there's not, I'm out of time. Instead of thinking, so let me just quickly say, suppose I have this situation where I have a D brain. So X is equal to zero at the ends of the string. If I t-dualize that to y, then y will have Neumann conditions. The statement that x equals zero at the two ends of the string means that the momentum, this is the extra dimension I'm thinking about here, the momentum is equal to zero. So Dirichlet conditions translate after t-duality to the statement that the momentum carried by the field is zero. Okay, that means you're discretizing the momentum. You're just putting it equal to zero. Suppose you had discretized it just by compactification. You can't really tell the difference between putting n equal to zero and p equal to zero. The result is you've just got one value. However, in this case, there is a special dimension in which the what we would call the tachyon and the massless vector particle have the same. See, the problem with the massless scalars are these b minus a half zero states. If you compactify at a particular radius, this is degenerate with two other states that are not really in the Hilbert space but are formally there, and it's an overall isovector under an SU2. So I'm saying that the C equals 1 model compactified, the C equals 1 bosonic model compactified at a particular radius supports an SU2 symmetry or an O3 symmetry. This is a well-known fact. The normal D brain, the normal abelian D brain, the P is identified in this with J3. So the normal abelian D brain condition is that rotations around the three axis of this SU2 are zero. But why not also impose the other two J equal to zero? So a normal D brain is J3 equals zero. I'm saying strengthen that to J3 or JA. Psi equals 0 for A equals 1, 2, and 3. That has the effect of removing one mode from the, it turns out. I mean, this, you have to do some analysis to convince yourself of this. But that basically explains this 1 minus W a half to the half. You are removing the massless scalar in that C equals 1 theory. If you have six of them, you will have added six dimensions to make the theory critical, but you won't have any of the massless scalars in the spectrum. They will all have been projected out by this more powerful condition.
So you're compactified on the torus at the six product of six.
Six times, yeah. It's kind of meat-handed, but I mean, there may be a more subtle way of doing this.
SU2 to the 6,
but you're
projecting out
all of the, you're forcing it to be invariant under SU2 to the 6.
All these.
Yes. All we know is that it's certainly consistent at the open string tree level. Unitarity involves making sure that this invariance is maintained on the intermediate states, and that involves
a group projector,
which in effect, I think, means that you're gauging the 6 extra SU2s. I have to think about that a little more. Anyway, I'm way out of time, so I'm happy to discuss more of this.
You're not just rediscovering Liouville theory, you're doing something really different. Is that right? I mean,
well, Liouville theory had an e to the phi term.
But the string would move in five dimensions in Liouville theory. Your string doesn't move in the Liouville direction, does it? It doesn't have us.
Right, not the one that comes out of the unitarity.
But the string is confined to being four dimensional.
Yeah, the open string.
How do you get, you don't get a constant string tension in four dimensional?
you have this. I mean, you have a. You have the. It's basically like a D brain.
Yeah, except the string in ADS, you know, in five-dimensional ADS space, wanders out into the fifth dimension.
Yes, the middle of the open. The endpoints.
Well, this is just a flat space. It's not. It's a flat extra dimension. I don't think it's an ADS dimension.
Well, therefore, is that enough?
What? It's not an ADS dimension.
Right. So therefore, it's been an oblong back.
Well, the ends don't move, but the body of it does.
Body of the open string does move into the fifth dimension.
What bothers me is that you then have a string tension all the way down to zero separation between the endpoints of the string. Your confining potential never becomes Coulombic.
Right, for this case, yes. But this potential is not, is something that's, that slope is going to go to zero at the end of the day. I'm modeling, I guess you weren't here when I was describing what I was doing. I'm modeling the gluon as a very high tension open string. I'm modeling the gluon as a very high tension or a very low alpha prime open string. So that's not my confining force. The confining force comes out of the interactions of these open strings with each other. If it comes out. I mean, hopefully it comes out, but I certainly haven't gotten close to proving it. There is one thing I didn't say that I should say. Let me just say it very quickly. If I don't have the Ramon sector, the closed string theory has a tachyon. One reason for putting the Ramon fermions in is to cancel that tachyon. But in this case, we're trying to get Yang-Mills theory, which is supposed to confine. So we don't want the vacuum to stay the same as it is in perturbation theory. So the tachyon could conceivably actually be a benefit. I mean, it might be the vacuum stability indicator that says that we should go into the confining vacuum.
I'm sorry, you're not removing all the non-singlet states in these extra six crawled-up circles, right?
Well, that's the most extreme version of this. I'm sorry?
You need them to restore unitarity.
Let's see. Let me write down a partition function and show you what I mean. So remember, we're doing the subcritical theory. So the partition function is 1 minus w to the 1/2 product 1 plus w to the r being half integer. This is to the d minus 1. The thing that happens when you analyze the physical state conditions in subcritical dimensions, the null states are much smaller. In effect, the non-zero modes, the non-lowest modes lose only one component, and the lowest modes, 1/2 and 1, lose two components. This state, the state that's removed by the condition is b minus 1/2. A lot more is removed as well. But among other things, the b minus 1/2 state is removed by this invariance condition. But I'm also removing all the non-singlets. In order to get this counting, and in order to get this partition function, I have to actually remove all the non-singlets under the SU2. I can discuss that in more detail later.
So you're picking certain sectors of, so to speak, if we think about the NSR. And does this combination enough to guarantee modular invariance of the partition function?
Modular invariance of the closed string. So the closed string theory is modular invariant if you keep NS plus NS plus, NS minus NS minus, R plus, and R minus, R minus. That's the modular invariant condition on the closed string. So this is what's been called the type 0 closed string. It's a different realization of modular invariance.
Okay.
So the open string has been projected in different ways, but the closed string is there in all its glory. Anything else?
Yes, I had a question about, so when you had this lattice description, mm-hmm. when you had, you, at some point you said that S was zero, which was aligned with me, and it wasn't.
Or I forget which way I said it.
But
the potential term is dropped or not.
The dx d sigma squared term.
Right.
The coefficient there.
Right.
It could be 0 or 1.
Yeah.
Can you see that this coming from the continuum action? If you have, I see the x becomes discontinuous when I go across. Why do you say you drop that d-sigma?
Well, the ends are free. They're not bound to each other anymore. The Neumann conditions mean that that a bound string is broken into two free, and there are two free ends where they used to be bound together. At the lattice level, that means the potential between the, at the, basically what you're doing with the lattice is you're replacing this, you're modeling the string as a bunch of balls on springs, and when it breaks, you're dropping the spring between two balls. It's pretty simple-minded, actually.
Good distinctions.